More than 50 metric tons of corn have left Ukrainian ports as part of a UN brokered deal.
The first shipment of grain since the war in Ukraine left the country earlier this week. These shipments are still just a fraction of the 20 million tons of grain Ukraine says are trapped.
Plus, what does Ukraine's new Children of War digital portal hope to achieve?
The main goal of this platform is to help parents and law enforcement agencies to collect information about children who actually suffered during the war.
And later in the program, could Russia be taking gold out of Africa to prop up its economy and skirt international sanctions? Today is Friday, August 5th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. A UN-backed deal to export Ukrainian grain that's been trapped by Russia's invasion seems to be working. Associated Press correspondent Donna Warder starts us off as more of the previously blockaded grain sets sail.
Three more ships with grain have left ports in Ukraine and are headed to Turkey for inspection. The ships are loaded with more than 58,000 tons of corn. Ukraine is one of the world's main breadbaskets, and the trapped grain has helped create a sharp rise in food prices and has been raising fears of a global hunger crisis. The first shipment of grain since the war in Ukraine left the country earlier this week. These shipments are still just a fraction of the 20 million tons of grain Ukraine says are trapped in the country's silos and ports. I'm Donna Warder.
With this next series of grain shipments now underway, we pick things up from yesterday's program with the second half of Michael Lippin's conversation with Neil Roberts, a maritime insurance specialist at the Lloyd's Market Association in London. In this part of their chat, Michael begins by asking what Roberts thinks is behind Russia's acceptance of the grain shipment deal with Ukraine.
Personal opinion, I think it's pragmatism. After all, the talks were authorized at the highest level. The agreement to sign them was authorized at the highest level. And the attack on Odessa was authorized at the highest level, probably to send a message of continuing ability and yet forbearance in this particular example, so that Russia will benefit from the excellent publicity that will gain from helping its partners in Asia and the Middle East.
So, Neil, given your experience with the Lloyd's Market Association and with the marine insurance industry, what can you tell us about how the marine insurance business is involved in these kinds of grain shipments?
Okay, well, there's two parts to this. There's, first of all, the vessels that are alongside in the Ukrainian ports. They are still covered because they went in with probably a portion of their 12-month cover still running. So they're still undercover, and they will come out with the conditions they had. In terms of vessels going in, that's slightly more difficult because they would seek coverage from the war market. So vessels have hull and cargo covers placed separately. They are annual. And to go into a what we call a listed area, an area where there's perceived enhanced risk, then owners have to apply for dispensation from insurers that they can have coverage. And at that point, the insurers assess the specifics of the voyage and may or may not decide to charge additional premium to reflect the risk involved.
Do you have any knowledge of how insurers are handling requests from shippers to have more grain shipments covered? Are they charging higher premiums, for example?
Well, at the moment, there haven't been any going in. So it's a bit early to say what they'll be doing, but we expect them to adopt a commercial yet pragmatic approach to this, because this is a humanitarian exercise. It's in everyone's interest that it takes place. But there is some information they still really would require in order to look at the individual shipments. We don't have, for instance, the details of the ships involved, because that's something that will come out of the JCC in Istanbul. Until you have the name of the assured or the vessel, it's difficult to issue the cover. So There has been a welcome announcement of a cargo facility that's in place, and that's ready on standby, if you like, for business. But the cargo depends on the hull, and the hulls haven't been authorised yet, and the arrangements for those hulls to transit are still in draft, and they're working around the clock to do that. We expect them in the next few days, and then there'll be a gradual start to the programme. And once it's running, it should be, given everything being equal, it should be pretty successful. Of course, there is always the chance of the drifting mine, and that has to be factored into the risk calculus, but the Ukrainians are guaranteeing safe passage so far as they can out of their waters.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Neil Roberts, Head of Marine and Aviation Insurance with the Lloyd's Market Association in London. Thank you for speaking to Flashpoint Ukraine.
Pleasure. Thank you.
As administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power is dealing with a global food crisis that has hundreds of millions of people going hungry, conflicts on the African continent, the economic disruptions of the pandemic, drought, and other extremes typical of climate change. Well, they've all been factors that have been compounded by Russia invading Ukraine, deepening food shortages and raising prices as one top global grain producer made war on another. The AP's Ellen Nickmeyer recently sat down with Power for an exclusive interview following Power's recent trip to Africa. Power described the conditions that she witnessed as being bleak.
The worst consequences of the food crisis haven't yet been felt. We are on the cusp of something very, very grim.
Africa has seen four consecutive failed rainy seasons, and Power says that's created a situation where the livestock are often in famine conditions, meaning that they're the ones who often perish first, calling that a canary in the coal mine for humanity.
Now we're at almost 20 million people who are going hungry and who are dependent on this emergency food assistance. But, other donors are stretched pretty thin. Other countries are stretched thin. Because the food crisis is a global food crisis, because Putin made this war on Ukraine starting in February.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently toured several African countries where he blamed the grain shortage and acute food insecurity on Western sanctions on Moscow rather than Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Power countered by saying that the United States will not allow Russia to control the narrative of the food crisis amid a time of war. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Children of War digital portal recently opened this week in Ukraine. Joining us from Kyiv is reporter Anna Chernikova. Anna, what is this portal?
As of the 1st of August, this portal started its operation. It was created by the Ministry of Reintegration of Ukraine, together with the National Information Bureau, and this was done on behalf of the President Office. So basically, these are two main operation institutions, and these institutions are in charge of that. We also know that informational and analytical support for the team of this platform is provided by the Government of Canada through their project supporting governmental reforms in Ukraine. So basically, this is cooperation within Ukrainian authorities and organizations and with international support.
Anna, this seems like a huge undertaking. What exactly are they trying to achieve with this portal?
So basically, due to war, a lot of children have suffered already and unfortunately continue to suffer. And basically, the main goal of this platform is to help parents and law enforcement agencies to collect information about children who actually suffered during the war. As what we know from Daria Herasimuk, who is authorized advisor to the President of Ukraine on children's rights and children rehabilitation, and she is one of those in charge. She said that there are two main functions of this portal, basically. The first one is to inform, so basically provide up-to-date information and consolidated information about children who suffered as a result of Russia-Ukraine war. This includes people, the children who were killed, wounded, missing, deported, etc. This portal would provide up-to-date information by law enforcement agencies like the National Police and Prosecutor General's Office, as well as the National Information Bureau. Second one is to help find children. And this is what the platform allows to contact law enforcement agencies. So either for anyone, basically, who knows something about a particular child, or, you know, for those who were helping, for example, families to search for the children and you know, got some information. So basically, they can provide information to National Police again, yes, and Office of the General Prosecutor. The site can be used by the parents who lost their children, or a child displaced or deported, or whose children were deported or they were separated.
Looking at the bigger picture, what are the latest estimates about how many children have been affected by war, which has thus created the necessity for this portal?
So as of August 1st, the latest numbers that we have, that at least 359 children were killed, unfortunately, 700 wounded, 208 are missing, and in terms of deported, the number, unfortunately, is much bigger. So we know that at least 5,700 children were actually illegally deported to Russia. And for the moment, we know that more than 4,000 children were already found, those missing, you know, within the country, and only 47 were actually returned from deportation. However, this number could be much bigger because, for example, Russian officials claim that more than 450,000 children were actually deported to their territory.
Reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
U.S. broadcaster CNN has uncovered an elaborate Russian plan to plunder Sudan's gold as a way to bolster Russia against strong Western sanctions and to help finance Moscow's war effort in Ukraine. Documents and interviews in the CNN report also suggest Russia has colluded with Sudan's military leaders, allowing billions of dollars in gold to bypass Sudanese authorities and be flown out of the country. Heather Ashby, a senior program officer and Russian analyst with the United States Institute of Peace, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that a report on Russia's plundering of Sudanese gold appears to be true.
Russia has a long history of engaging in these type of smuggling operations that go back to the early Soviet period after the Bolshevik Revolution, from my own research. And so during that time period, because of the difficulty of a collapse in state, they were taking the Tsar's jewels and selling them around the world. And so this has been an aspect of the way the Russian system has operated for 100 years of engaging in different types of illegal smuggling practices to get around sanctions, to get around other rules of the international system. So I'm definitely not surprised to hear this. The second aspect of the article and your question that I want to highlight is that Russia was also helping Venezuela get around the sanctions that were imposed on their government. And they were helping to transport that gold to Venezuelan gold to different parts of the world, particularly in East Africa. So this is just building up on that long history of Russia smuggling, as well as their support and help of the Venezuelan regime to get around sanctions.
How come we don't hear more about this? How come this isn't really talked about in public?
I think there's so much going on with Russia's war against Ukraine, that unjustified war, that it's difficult to pull the thread on so many other issues that are connected to that, as well as the sanctions, that it may not receive enough attention. The other aspect is, given the countries where Russia is active in Africa, it's difficult to have journalists go to those countries and dig deeper. There is a situation that happened in the Central African Republic a few years ago. Investigative journalists go into the Central African Republic to understand what Russia was doing in partnership with the Carr government, and those journalists were murdered. And so that's part of the reasons why you don't hear these stories, because of the difficulty in tracking that information and making sure journalists are safe when they're conducting that research.
What do Sudan's military rulers get out of the deal?
I think right now, since they staged that coup that happened late last year, they may be looking for a country to help endorse their system, because the U.S., the Europeans, and the international system condemned that coup and the attacks against pro-democracy protesters, that Russia becomes this other option of helping to endorse the government and their practices.
Where are these smuggling operations occurring inside Sudan?
They are in different parts of Sudan. One is that you can see it where Sudan's border meets the Central African Republic, where Russia is active through the Wagner Group, a private mercenary company. And then you can see it move in then north out of the country.
Do you know anything about this Russian in particular? He's a convicted kidnapper. I think you pronounce his name Alexander Sergeyevich Kuznetsov.
I haven't heard much about him, but that's not too surprising, because it's so difficult to receive information about the individuals who are connected with Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's heavily sanctioned and has been reported to be the funder for the Wagner Group that's spread across different parts of Africa. And so it's challenging for researchers, analysts like myself, as well as journalists, to know exactly what is the composition of the Wagner Group, Prigozhin's network, and the individuals involved. Every now and then, such as this situation, you'll find the name of an individual that will shed some light on it and enable journalists, analysts, and governments to dig deeper to understand what this network looks like.
From the United States Institute of Peace, Senior Program Officer and Russian analyst Heather Ashby, speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. During yesterday's program, host Michael Lippin introduced Douglas Rediker, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, as well as a former U.S. executive board member at the International Monetary Fund. Now, we continue their conversation with Rediker discussing the phenomenon of Russians rallying around their leader in response to U.S. sanctions and whether that means that sanctions could backfire.
Well, if the goal was to create either the oligarchs or the elites or the Russian people to feel the pressure from the West as a result of sanctions and somehow remove Vladimir Putin and his regime from office, then I think that was a naive starting point. It certainly has not succeeded, but I don't think that anybody, I shouldn't say anybody, I don't think most people in the government and outside truly believed that by leveling the sanctions we put in place, this was going to create a popular uprising against Vladimir Putin and his regime. I think that the way you have to look at sanctions is they serve three basic purposes. One is to deter behavior. Two is to be used as negotiating leverage. And three is to be used as punishment. Clearly, we are well into the punishment phase of this. A lot of what's being done is intended to punish. There's no long-term strategic benefit to sanctioning Vladimir Putin's mistress. She is not going to change the course of the war. But there is a sense that bad behavior needs to be punished, and so we are doing so. Nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't get you to a goal of changing the regime. I think that at the beginning, the use of the sanctions as negotiating leverage was not really on the table. I don't think that by sanctioning central bank reserves and other financial transactions, as well as the Export Control Act, I don't think that was intended to be dialed up or dialed down, depending on Vladimir Putin's response. I do think at this point, however, if and when negotiations take place, some of those sanctions will probably be relaxed in one way or another as part of a means to get to a deal. And then the first goal of sanctions is to deter. And I think even President Biden admitted these were not sanctions that were intended to deter. That's pretty easy to see. The war is ongoing. The invasion was not deterred. So it's hard to argue that these served a deterrent purpose.
Are there some sanctions that the U.S. could put on Russia that could have a much more serious impact? Are there any big guns that have not sort of fired yet at the Russians?
Well, the big gun, artillery, missiles, bombs are about the energy sector. So we have not actually, we collectively, meaning the U.S., the EU, the G7, have not actually imposed secondary sanctions or a global export ban from Russia on oil and gas. The reason for that is, well, number one, it would be very hard to enforce. And number two, you know, we and the Europeans are very dependent on Russia for energy. The U.S. less so directly, but the Biden administration is deeply concerned about oil prices, and Russia is a major exporter into the global oil markets. Europe is definitely concerned most of all about natural gas, to which they are very reliant on Russia, and that is their primary concern. Natural gas prices in Europe have skyrocketed. It's the equivalent of $600 a barrel for oil is what they're paying for natural gas right now. And this is not even the peak heating season, obviously, which will come later on this year. So there are a series of energy-related sanctions that could, in fact, be tried by the West. But those would probably not work because you've got countries like India and China and others that would thumb their nose at it and say, if you're forcing us to choose between importing Russian energy or relying on the U.S. for its secondary sanctions, that's not necessarily a choice anyone wants to see them have to make. But we could do it, but it would cause massive economic and social and geopolitical risks. And I don't think anybody wants to take a step in that direction too far.
That was the Brookings Institution's Douglas Rediker speaking to VOA's own Michael Lippin. Thousands of Ukrainians whose lives have been upended by war in their country continue to rely on aid that's being provided by humanitarians from around the world. Greg Flakus recently visited the Poland-Ukraine border and reports for VOA that help will likely be needed for a long time to come.
When Ukrainian refugees cross over the border into Poland, they encounter tents, where non-governmental charity groups from around the world offer them nutritious food and temporary shelter. Few of the refugees have serious health problems, but some need prescribed medication they had to leave behind. David Christensen is a nurse from San Francisco who volunteers at a clinic with a group called Rescuers Without Borders.
We keep this place running 24/7. Usually the patients come in looking for medication refills, you know, blood pressure, thyroid, heart medications, because a lot of people they had to leave with just the clothes on their back and they have chronic issues.
He says the pace has slowed a lot since crowds swarmed over the border in February and March.
It was just a tidal wave of people coming through. Now it's just handfuls at a time, some people going to get supplies and then go back. Other people just have nowhere else to go.
As hard as the situation may be for refugees and people who fled to more peaceful areas in Ukraine, it's worse for the many civilians who had to remain in conflict zones, according to International Medical Corps spokesman Todd Bernhardt.
Typically, the people who are left behind in a conflict situation are the people who are poorer, who don't have the means to leave. They're the people most in need of humanitarian assistance, and those are the people that we try to focus on.
Bernhardt, who recently returned to Los Angeles after visiting Ukraine, says his organization, which has done humanitarian work around the world for decades, is trying to fortify and equip area hospitals as bombardments continue.
I suspect that this conflict is going to grind on for quite some time. The people are going to need help for quite some time.
And he says that even if the war ended today, Ukrainians who have been injured physically and mentally will need help for years to come. Greg Flakus for VOA News, Houston.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, DC.